interest, which is the only immutable point in the human heart, what means will you have of governing the world except by fear? When I am told that, since the laws are weak and the populace is wild, since passions are excited and the authority of virtue is paralyzed, no measures must be taken to increase the rights of the democracy, I reply that it is for these very reasons that some measures of the kind must be taken, and I am persuaded that governments are still more interested in taking them than society at large, because governments are liable to be destroyed, and society cannot perish. I am not, however, inclined to exaggerate the example which America furnishes. In those states, the people are invested with political rights at a time when they could scarcely be abused, for the citizens were few in number and simple in their manners. As they have increased, the Americans have not augmented the power of the democracy, but they have, if I may use the expression, extended its dominions. It cannot be doubted that the moment at which political rights are granted to a people that had before been without them is a very critical, though it be a necessary one. A child may kill before he is aware of the value of life, and he may deprive another person of his property before he is aware that his own may be taken away from him. The lower orders, when first they are invested with political rights, stand, in relation to those rights, in the same position as the child does to the whole of nature, and the celebrated adage may then be applied to them, homo puella robusti. This truth may even be perceived in America. The states in which the citizens have enjoyed their rights longest are those in which they make the best use of them. It cannot be repeated too often that nothing is more fertile in prodigies than the art of being free, but there is nothing more arduous than the apprenticeship of liberty. Such is not the case with despotic institutions. Despotism often promises to make amends for 1,000 previous ills. It supports the right, it protects the oppressed, and it maintains public order. The nation is lulled by the temporary prosperity which accrues to it, until it is roused to a sense of its own misery. Liberty, on the contrary, is generally established in the midst of agitation. It is perfected by civil discord, and its benefits cannot be appreciated until it is already old. Respect for the law in the United States. It is not always feasible to consult the whole people, either directly or indirectly, in the formation of the law. But it cannot be denied that, when such a measure is possible, the authority of the law is very much augmented. This popular origin, which impairs the excellence and the wisdom of legislation, contributes prodigiously to increase its power. There is an amazing strength in the expression of the determination of a whole people, and when it declares itself, the imagination of those who are at most inclined to contest it is overawed by its authority. The truth of this fact is very well known by parties, and they consequently strive to make out a majority whenever they can. If they have not the greater number of voters on their side, they assert that the true majority abstained from voting. And if they are foiled even there, they have recourse to the body of those persons who had no votes to give. In the United States, except slaves, servants, and paupers in the receipt of relief from the townships, there is no class of persons who does not exercise the elective franchise and who do not indirectly contribute to make the laws. Those who design to attack the laws must consequently either modify the opinion of the nation or trample upon its decision. A second reason, which is still more weighty, may be further adduced. In the United States, everyone is personally interested in enforcing the obedience of the whole community to the law. For as the minority may shortly rally the majority to its principles, it is interested in professing that respect for the decrees of the legislator which it may soon have occasion to claim for its own. However irksome an enactment may be, the citizen of the United States complies with it, not only because it is the work of the majority, but because it originates in his own authority, and he regards it as a contract to which he is himself a party. In the United States, then, that numerous and turbulent multitude does not exist, which always looks upon the law as its natural enemy, and accordingly surveys it with fear and with distrust. It is impossible, on the other hand, not to perceive that all classes display the utmost reliance upon the legislation of their country, and that they are attached to it by a kind of parental affection. I am wrong, however, in saying all classes, for as in America, the European scale of authority is inverted. The wealthy are there placed in a position analogous to that of the poor in the Old World, and it is the opulent classes which frequently look upon the law with suspicion. I have already observed that the advantage of democracy is not, as has been sometimes asserted, that it protects the interests of the whole community, but simply that it protects those of the majority. In the United States, where the poor rule, the rich have always some reason to dread the abuses of their power. This natural anxiety of the rich may produce a sullen dissatisfaction, but society is not disturbed by it. For the same reason which induces the rich to withhold their confidence in the legislative authority makes them obey its mandates. Their wealth, which prevents them from making the law, prevents them from withstanding it. Amongst civilized nations, revolts are rarely excited, except by such persons as have nothing to lose by them. And if the laws of a democracy are not always worthy of respect, at least they always obtain it. For those who usually infringe the laws have no excuse for not complying with the enactments they have themselves made, and by which they are themselves benefited, whilst the citizens whose interests might be promoted by the infraction of them are induced, by their character and their stations, to submit to the decisions of the legislature, whatever they may be. Besides which, the people in America obeys the law not only because it emanates from the popular authority, but because that authority may modify it in any points which may prove vexatory. A law is observed because it is a self-imposed evil in the first place, and an evil of transient duration in the second. Activity which pervades all the branches of the body politic in the United States. Influence which it exercises upon society. On passing from a country in which free institutions are established to one where they do not exist, the traveler is struck by the change. In the former, all is bustle and activity. In the latter, everything is calm and motionless. In the one, amelioration and progress are the general topics of inquiry. In the other, it seems as if the community only aspired to repose in the enjoyment of the advantages which it has acquired. Nevertheless, the country which exerts itself so strenuously to promote its welfare is generally more wealthy and more prosperous than that which appears to be so contented with its lot. And when we compare them together, we can scarcely conceive how so many new wants are daily felt in the former, while so many few seem to occur in the latter. If this remark is applicable to those free countries in which monarchical and aristocratic institutions subsist, it is still more striking with regard to democratic republics. In these states, it is not only a portion of the people which is busied with the amelioration of its social condition, but the whole community is engaged in the task. And it is not the exigencies and the conveniences of a single class for which a provision is to be made, but the exigencies and the convenience of all ranks of life. It is not impossible to conceive the surpassing liberty which the Americans enjoy. Some idea may likewise be formed of the extreme equality which subsists amongst them, but the political activity which pervades the United States must be seen in order to be understood. No sooner do you set foot upon the American soil than you are stunned by a kind of tumult. A confused clamor is heard on every side, and a thousand simultaneous voices demand the immediate satisfaction of their social wants. Everything is in motion around you. Here, the people of one quarter of a town are met to decide upon the building of a church. There, the election of a representative is going on. A little further, the delegates of a district are posting to the town in order to consult upon some local improvements. Or in another place, the laborers of a village quit their plows to deliberate upon the project of a road or a public school. Meetings are called for the sole purpose of declaring their disapprobation of the line of conduct pursued by the government. whilst in other assemblies the citizens salute the authorities of the day as the fathers of their country. Societies are formed which regard drunkenness as the principal cause of the evils under which the state labors, and which solemnly bind themselves to give a constant example of temperance. Author's note: at the time of my stay in the United States, the temperance societies already consisted of more than 270,000 members, and their effect had been to diminish the consumption of fermented liquors by 500,000 gallons per annum in the state of Pennsylvania alone. The great political agitation of the American legislative bodies, which is the only kind of excitement that attracts the attention of foreign countries, is a mere episode or a sort of continuation of that universal movement, which originates in the lowest classes of the people and extends successively to all the ranks of society. It is impossible to spend more efforts in the pursuit of enjoyment. The cares of political life engross a most prominent place in the occupation of a citizen in the United States, and almost the only pleasure of which an American has any idea is to take a part in the government, and to discuss the part he has taken. This feeling pervades the most trifling habits of life. Even the women frequently attend public meetings and listen to political harangues as a recreation after their household labors. Debating clubs are to a certain extent a substitute for theatrical entertainments. An American cannot converse, but he can discuss, and when he attempts to talk, he falls into a dissertation. He speaks to you as if he was addressing a meeting, and if he should chance to warm in the course of the discussion, he will infallibly say, "Gentlemen," to the person with whom he is conversing. In some countries, the inhabitants display a certain repugnance to avail themselves of the political privileges with which the law invests them. It would seem that they set too high a value upon their time to spend it on the interests of the community, and they prefer to withdraw within the exact limits of a wholesome egotism marked out by four sunk fences and a quickset hedge. But if an American were condemned to confine his activity to his own affairs, he would be robbed of one half of his existence. He would feel an immense void in the life which he is accustomed to lead, and his wretchedness would be unbearable. Author's note: the same remark was made at Rome under the first Caesars. Montesquieu somewhere alludes to the excessive despondency of certain Roman citizens who, after the excitement of political life, were all at once flung back into the stagnation of private life. I am persuaded that, if ever a despotic government is established in America, it will find it more difficult to surmount the habits which free institutions have engendered than to conquer the attachment of the citizens to freedom. This ceaseless agitation which democratic government has introduced into the political world influences all social intercourse. I am not sure that upon the whole this is not the greatest advantage of democracy, and I am much less inclined to applaud it for what it does than for what it causes to be done. It is incontestable that the people frequently conduct public business very ill, but it is impossible that the lower orders should take a part in public business without extending the circle of their ideas and without quitting the ordinary routine of their mental acquirements. The humblest individual who is called upon to cooperate in the government of society acquires a certain degree of self-respect, and as he possesses authority, he can command the services of minds much more enlightened than his own. He is canvassed by a multitude of applicants who seek to deceive him in a thousand different ways, but who instruct him by their deceit. He takes a part in political undertakings which did not originate in his own conception, but which give him a taste for undertakings of the kind. New ameliorations are daily pointed out on the property which he holds in common with others, and this gives him the desire of improving that property which is more peculiarly his own. He is perhaps neither happier nor better than those who came before him, but he is better informed and more active. I have no doubt that the democratic institutions of the United States, joined to the physical constitution of the country, are the cause, not the direct, as is so often asserted, but the indirect cause, of the prodigious commercial activity of the inhabitants. It is not engendered by the laws, but the people learns how to promote it by the experience derived from legislation. When the opponents of democracy assert that a single individual performs the duties which he undertakes much better than the government of the community, it appears to me that they are perfectly right. The government of an individual, supposing an equality of instruction on either side, is more consistent, more persevering, and more accurate than that of a multitude, and it is much better qualified judiciously to discriminate the characters of the men it employs. If any deny what I advance, they have certainly never seen a democratic government, or have formed their opinion upon very partial evidence. It is true that even when local circumstances and the disposition of the people allow democratic institutions to subsist, they never display a regular and methodical system of government. Democratic liberty is far from accomplishing all the projects it undertakes with the skill of an adroit despotism. It frequently abandons them before they have borne their fruits, or risks them when the consequences may prove dangerous. But in the end, it produces more than any absolute government, and if it do fewer things well, it does a greater number of things. Under its sway, the transactions of the public administration are not nearly so important as what is done by private exertion. Democracy does not confer the most skillful kind of government upon the people, but it produces that which the most skillful governments are frequently unable to awaken, namely, an all-pervading and restless activity, a superabundant force, and an energy which is inseparable from it, and which may, under favorable circumstances, beget the most amazing benefits. These are the true advantages of democracy. In the present age, when the destinies of Christendom seem to be in suspense, some hasten to assail democracy as its foe, whilst it is yet in its early growth, and others are ready with their vows of adoration for this new deity which is springing forth from chaos. But both parties are very imperfectly acquainted with the object of their hatred or of their desires. They strike in the dark and distribute their blows by mere chance. We must first understand what the purport of society and the aim of government is held to be. If it be your intention to confer a certain elevation upon the human mind, and to teach it to regard the things of this world with generous feelings, to inspire men with a scorn of mere temporal advantage, to give birth to living convictions, and to keep alive the spirit of honorable devotedness, if you hold it to be a good thing to refine the habits, to embellish the manners, to cultivate the arts of a nation, and to promote the love of poetry, of beauty, and of renown, if you would constitute a people not unfitted to act with power upon all other nations, nor unprepared for those high enterprises which, whatever be the result of its efforts, will leave a name forever famous in time, if you believe such to be the principal objects of society, you must avoid the government of democracy, which would be a very uncertain guide to the end you have in view. But if you hold it to be expedient to divert the moral and intellectual activity of man to the production of comfort and to the acquirement of the necessities of life, if a clear understanding be more profitable to man than genius, if your object be not to stimulate the virtues of heroism, but to create habits of peace, if you had rather witness vices than crimes, and are content to meet with fewer noble deeds, provided offenses be diminished in the same proportion, if instead of living in the midst of a brilliant state of society, you are contented to have prosperity around you, if, in short, you are of opinion that the principal object of a government is not to confer the greatest possible share of power and of glory upon the body of the nation, but to ensure the greatest degree of enjoyment and the least degree of misery to each of the individuals who compose it, if such be your desires, you can have no surer means of satisfying them than by equalizing the conditions of men and establishing democratic institutions. But if the time be past at which such a choice was possible, and if some superhuman power impel us towards one or the other of these two governments without consulting our wishes, let us at least endeavor to make the best of that which is allotted to us, and let us so inquire into its good and its evil propensities as to be able to foster the former and repress the latter to the utmost. Chapter 15. Unlimited Power of the Majority in the United States and Its Consequences. The very essence of democratic government consists in the absolute sovereignty of the majority, for there is nothing in democratic states which is capable of resisting it. Most of the American constitutions have sought to increase this natural strength of the majority by artificial means. Authors note, we observed, in examining the federal constitution, that the efforts of the legislators of the Union had been diametrically opposed to the present tendency. The consequence has been that the federal government is more independent in its sphere than that of the states. But the federal government scarcely ever interferes in any but external affairs, and the governments of the state are in reality the authorities which direct society in America. The legislature is, of all political institutions, the one which is most easily swayed by the wishes of the majority. The Americans determined that the members of the legislature should be elected by the people immediately, and for a very brief term, in order to subject them not only to the general convictions, but even to the daily passion of their constituents. The members of both houses are taken from the same class in society, and are nominated in the same manner, so that the modifications of the legislative bodies are almost as rapid and quite as irresistible as those of a single assembly. It is to a legislature thus constituted that almost all the authority of the government has been entrusted. But whilst the law increased the strength of those authorities which of themselves were strong, it enfeebled more and more those which were naturally weak. It deprived the representatives of the executive of all stability and independence, and by subjecting them completely to the caprices of the legislature, it robbed them of the slender influence which the nature of a democratic government might have allowed them to retain. In several states, the judicial power was also submitted to the elective discretion of the majority, and in all of them, its existence was made to depend on the pleasure of the legislative authority, since the representatives were empowered annually to regulate the stipend of the judges. Custom, however, has done even more than the law. A proceeding which will in the end set all the guarantees of representative government at naught is becoming more and more general in the United States. It frequently happens that the electors, who choose a delegate, point out a certain line of conduct to him, and impose upon him a certain number of positive obligations which he is pledged to fulfill. With the exception of the tumult, this comes to the same thing as if the majority of the populace held its deliberations in the marketplace. Several other circumstances concur in rendering the power of the majority in America not only preponderant, but irresistible. The moral authority of the majority is partly based upon the notion that there is more intelligence and more wisdom in a great number of men collected together than in a single individual, and that the quantity of legislators is more important than their quality. The theory of equality is in fact applied to the intellect of man, and human pride is thus assailed in its last retreat by a doctrine which the minority hesitate to admit, and in which they very slowly concur. Like all other powers, and perhaps more than all other powers, the authority of the many requires the sanction of time. At first, it enforces obedience by constraint, but its laws are not respected until they have long been maintained. The right of governing society, which the majority supposes itself to derive from its superior intelligence, was introduced into the United States by the first settlers, and this idea, which would be sufficient of itself to create a free nation, has now been amalgamated with the manners of the people and the minor incidents of social intercourse. The French, under the old monarchy, held it for a maxim, which is still a fundamental principle of the English Constitution, that the king could do no wrong, and if he did do wrong, the blame was imputed to his advisers. This notion was highly favorable to habits of obedience, and it enabled the subject to complain of the law without ceasing to love and honor the lawgiver. The Americans entertain the same opinion with respect to the majority. The moral power of the majority is founded upon yet another principle, which is that the interests of the many are to be preferred to those of the few. It will readily be perceived that the respect here professed for the rights of the majority must naturally increase or diminish according to the state of parties. When a nation is divided into several irreconcilable factions, the privilege of the majority is then overlooked because it is intolerable to comply with its demands. If there existed in America a class of citizens whom the legislating majority sought to deprive of exclusive privileges which they had possessed for ages, and to bring down from an elevated station to the level of the ranks of the multitude, it is probable that the minority would be less ready to comply with its laws. But as the United States were colonized by men holding equal rank amongst themselves, there is as yet no natural or permanent source of dissension between the interests of its different inhabitants. There are certain communities in which the persons who constitute the minority can never hope to draw over the majority to their side, because they must then give up the very point which is at issue between them. Thus, an aristocracy can never become a majority whilst it retains its exclusive privileges, and it cannot cede its privileges without ceasing to be an aristocracy. In the United States, political questions cannot be taken up in so general and absolute a manner, and all parties are willing to recognize the right of the majority, because they all hope to turn those rights to their own advantage at some future time. The majority, therefore, in that country exercises a prodigious actual authority and a moral influence which is scarcely less preponderant. No obstacles exist which can impede or so much as retard its progress, or which can induce it to heed the complaints of those whom it crushes upon its path. This state of things is fatal in itself and dangerous for the future. I have already spoken of the natural defects of democratic institutions, and they all of them increase at the exact ratio of the power of the majority. To begin with the most evident of them all, the mutability of the laws is an evil inherent in democratic government, because it is natural to democracies to raise men to power in very rapid succession. But this evil is more or less sensible in proportion to the authority and the means of action which the legislature possesses. In America, the authority exercised by the legislative bodies is supreme. Nothing prevents them from accomplishing their wishes with celerity and with irresistible power, whilst they are supplied by new representatives every year. That is to say, the circumstances which contribute most powerfully to democratic instability and which admit of the free application of caprice to every object in the state are here in full operation. In conformity with this principle, America is, at the present day, the country in the world where laws last the shortest time. Almost all the American constitutions have been amended within the course of 30 years. There is therefore not a single American state which has not modified the principles of its legislation in that lapse of time. As for the laws themselves, a single glance upon the archives of the different states of the Union suffices to convince one that in America the activity of the legislator never slackens. Not that the American democracy is naturally less stable than any other, but that it is allowed to follow its capricious propensities in the formation of the laws. Author's note: the legislative acts promulgated by the state of Massachusetts alone from the year 1780 to the present time already fill 3 stout volumes. And it must not be forgotten that the collection to which I allude was published in 1823, when many old laws which had fallen into disuse were omitted. The state of Massachusetts, which is not more populous than a department of France, may be considered as the most stable, the most consistent, and the most sagacious in its undertakings of the whole Union. The omnipotence of the majority and the rapid as well as absolute manner in which its decisions are executed in the United States has not only the effect of rendering the law unstable, but it exercises the same influence upon the execution of the law and the conduct of the public administration. As the majority is the only power which it is important to court, all its projects are taken up with the greatest ardor, but no sooner is its attention distracted than all this ardor ceases. Whilst in the free states of Europe, the administration is at once independent and secure, so that the projects of the legislature are put into execution although its immediate attention may be directed to other objects. In America, certain ameliorations are undertaken with much more zeal and activity than elsewhere. In Europe, the same ends are promoted by much less social effort, more continuously applied. Some years ago, several pious individuals undertook to ameliorate the condition of the prisons. The public was excited by the statement which they put forward, and the regeneration of criminals became a very popular undertaking. New prisons were built, and for the first time the idea of reforming as well as of punishing the delinquent formed a part of prison discipline. But this happy alteration, in which the public had taken so heartily an interest, and which the exertions of the citizens had irresistibly accelerated, could not be completed in a moment. Whilst the new penitentiaries were being erected, and it was the pleasure of the majority that they should be terminated with all possible celerity, the old prisons existed, which still contained a great number of offenders. These jails became more unwholesome and more corrupt in proportion as the new establishments were beautified and improved, forming a contrast which may readily be understood. The majority was so eagerly employed in founding the new prisons that those which already existed were forgotten. And as the general attention was diverted to a novel object, the care which had hitherto been bestowed upon the others ceased. The salutary regulations of discipline were first relaxed and afterwards broken, so that in the immediate neighborhood of a prison which bore witness to the mild and enlightened spirit of our time, dungeons might be met with which reminded the visitor of the barbarity of the Middle Ages. Tyranny of the majority. I hold it to be an impious and an execrable maxim that, politically speaking, a people has a right to do whatsoever it pleases, and yet I have asserted that all authority originates in the will of the majority. Am I then in contradiction with myself? A general law, which bears the name of justice, has been made and sanctioned not only by a majority of this or that people, but by a majority of mankind. The rights of every people are consequently confined within the limits of what is just. A nation may be considered in the light of a jury which is empowered to represent society at large and to apply the great and general law of justice. Ought such a jury, which represents society, to have more power than the society in which the laws it applies originate? When I refuse to obey an unjust law, I do not contest the right which the majority has of commanding, but I simply appeal from the sovereignty of the people to the sovereignty of mankind. It has been asserted that a people can never entirely outstep the boundaries of justice and of reason in those affairs which are more peculiarly its own, and that consequently full power may fearlessly be given to the majority by which it is represented. But this language is that of a slave. A majority taken collectively may be regarded as a being whose opinions, and most frequently whose interests, are opposed to that of another being, which is styled a minority. If it be admitted that a man, possessing absolute power, may misuse that power by wronging his adversaries, why should a majority not be liable to the same reproach? Men are not apt to change their characters by agglomeration, nor does their patience in the presence of obstacles increase with the consciousness of their strength. Author's note: no one will assert that a people cannot forcibly wrong another people. But parties may be looked upon as lesser nations within a greater one, and they are aliens to each other. If, therefore, it be admitted that a nation can act tyrannically towards another nation, it cannot be denied that a party may do the same towards another party. And for these reasons, I can never willingly invest any number of my fellow creatures with that unlimited authority which I should refuse to any one of them. I do not think that it is possible to combine several principles in the same government, so as at the same time to maintain freedom, and really to oppose them to one another. The form of government, which is usually termed mixed, has always appeared to me to be a mere chimera. Accurately speaking, there is no such thing as a mixed government, with the meaning usually given to that word, because in all communities, some one principle of action may be discovered which preponderates over the others. England in the last century, which has been more especially cited as an example of this form of government, was in point of fact an essentially aristocratic state, although it comprised very powerful elements of democracy. For the laws and customs of the country were such that the aristocracy could not but preponderate in the end, and subject the direction of public affairs to its own will. The error arose from too much attention being paid to the actual struggle which was going on between the nobles and the people, without considering the probable issue of the contest, which was in reality the important point. When a community really has a mixed government, that is to say, when it is equally divided between two adverse principles, it must either pass through a revolution or fall into complete dissolution. I am therefore of the opinion that someone's social power must always be made to predominate over the others, but I think that liberty is endangered when this power is checked by no obstacles which may retard its course and force it to moderate its own vehemence. Unlimited power is in itself a bad and dangerous thing. Human beings are not competent to exercise it with discretion, and God alone can be omnipotent, because His wisdom and His justice are always equal to His power. But no power upon earth is so worthy of honor for itself, or for reverential obedience to the rights of which it represents, that I would consent to admit its uncontrolled and all-predominant authority. When I see that the right and the means of absolute command are conferred on a people or upon a king, upon an aristocracy or a democracy, a monarchy or a republic, I recognize the germ of tyranny, and I journey onward to a land of more hopeful institutions. In my opinion, the main evil of the present democratic institutions of the United States does not arise, as is often asserted in Europe, from their weakness, but from their overpowering strength. And I am not so much alarmed at the excessive liberty which reigns in that country as at the very inadequate securities which exist against tyranny. When an individual or a party is wronged in the United States, to whom can he apply for redress? If to public opinion constitutes the majority. If to the legislature, it represents the majority and implicitly obeys its injunctions. If to the executive power, it is appointed by the majority and remains a passive tool in its hands. The public troops consist of the majority under arms. The jury is the majority invested with the right of hearing judicial cases. And in certain states, even the judges are elected by the majority. However iniquitous or absurd the evil of which you complain may be, you must submit to it as well as you can. Author's note: a striking instance of the excesses which may be occasioned by the despotism of the majority occurred in Baltimore in the year 1812. At that time, the war was very popular in Baltimore. A journal which had taken the other side of the question excited the indignation of the inhabitants by its opposition. The populace assembled, broke the printing presses, and attacked the houses of the newspaper editors. The militia was called out, but no one obeyed the call. And the only means of saving the poor wretches who were threatened by the frenzy of the mob was to throw them into prison as common malefactors. But even this precaution was ineffectual. The mob collected again during the night. The magistrates again made a vain attempt to call out the militia. The prison was forced, and one of the newspaper editors was killed upon the spot, and the others were left for dead. The guilty parties were acquitted by the jury when they were brought to trial. I said one day to an inhabitant of Pennsylvania, "Be so good as to explain to me how it happens that in a state founded by Quakers and celebrated for its toleration, freed blacks are not allowed to exercise civil rights. They pay their taxes. Is it not fair that they should have a vote?" "You insult us," replied my informant, "if you imagine that our legislators could have committed so gross an act of injustice and intolerance." "What? Then the blacks possess the right of voting in this county?" "Without the smallest doubt." "How comes it, then, that at the polling booth this morning I did not perceive a single Negro in the whole meeting?" "This is not the fault of the law. The Negroes have an undisputed right of voting, but they voluntarily abstain from making their appearance." "A very pretty piece of modesty on their parts," rejoined I. "Why, the truth is that they are not disinclined to vote, but they are afraid of being maltreated, In this country, the law is sometimes unable to maintain its authority without the support of the majority. But in this case, the majority entertains very strong prejudices against the blacks, and the magistrates are unable to protect them in the exercise of their legal privileges. What? Then the majority claims the right not only of making the laws, but of breaking the laws it has made? If, on the other hand, a legislative power could be so constituted as to represent the majority without necessarily being the slave of its passions, an executive so as to retain a certain degree of uncontrolled authority, and a judiciary so as to remain independent of the other two powers, a government would be formed which would still be democratic without incurring any risk of tyrannical abuse. I do not say that tyrannical abuses frequently occur in America at the present day, but I maintain that no sure barrier is established against them, and that the causes which mitigate the government are to be found in the circumstances and the manners of the country more than in its laws. Effects of the unlimited power of the majority upon the arbitrary authority of the American public officers. A distinction must be drawn between tyranny and arbitrary power. Tyranny may be exercised by means of the law, and in that case it is not arbitrary. Arbitrary power may be exercised for the good of the community at large, in which case it is not tyrannical. Tyranny usually employs arbitrary means, but if necessary, it can rule without them. In the United States, the unbounded power of the majority, which is favorable to the legal despotism of the legislature, is likewise favorable to the arbitrary authority of the magistrate. The majority has an entire control over the law when it is made and when it is executed. And as it possesses an equal authority over those who are in power and the community at large, it considers public officers as its passive agents and readily confides the task of serving its designs to their vigilance. The details of their office and the privileges which they are to enjoy are rarely defined beforehand. But the majority treats them as a master does his servants when they are always at work in his sight, and he has the power of directing or reprimanding them at every instant. In general, the American functionaries are far more independent than the French civil officers within the sphere which is prescribed to them. Sometimes, even, they are allowed by the popular authority to exceed those bounds, and as they are protected by the opinion and backed by the cooperation of the majority, they venture upon such manifestations of their power as to astonish a European. By this means, habits are formed in the heart of a free country which may someday prove fatal to its liberties. Power exercised by the majority in America upon opinion. It is in the examination of the display of public opinion in the United States that we clearly perceive how far the power of the majority surpasses all powers with which we are acquainted in Europe. Intellectual principles exercise an influence which is so invisible and often so inappreciable that they baffle the toils of oppression. At the present time, the most absolute monarchs in Europe are unable to prevent certain notions, which are opposed to their authority, from circulating in secret throughout their dominions and even in their courts. Such is not the case in America. As long as the majority is still undecided, discussion is carried on. But as soon as its decision is irrevocably pronounced, a submissive silence is observed, and the friends, as well as the opponents of the measure, unite in assenting to its propriety. The reason of this is perfectly clear. No monarch is so absolute as to combine all the powers of society in his own hands, and to conquer all opposition with the energy of a majority which is invested with the right of making and of executing the laws. The authority of a king is purely physical, and it controls the actions of the subject without subduing his private will. But the majority possesses a power which is physical and moral at the same time. It acts upon the will as well as upon the actions of men, and it represses not only all contest, but all controversy. I know of no country in which there is so little true independence of mind and freedom of discussion as in America. In any constitutional state in Europe, every sort of religious and political theory may be advocated and propagated abroad. For there is no country in Europe so subdued by any single authority as not to contain citizens who are ready to protect the man who raises his voice in the cause of truth from the consequences of his hardihood. If he is unfortunate enough to live under an absolute government, the people is upon his side. If he inhabits a free country, he may find a shelter behind the authority of the throne, if he requires one. The aristocratic part of society supports him in some countries, and the democracy in others. But in a nation where democratic institutions exist, organized like those of the United States, there is but one sole authority, one single element of strength and of success, with nothing beyond it. In America, the majority raises very formidable barriers to the liberty of opinion. Within these barriers, an author may write whatever he pleases, but he will repent if he ever step beyond them. Not that he is exposed to the terrors of an auto-da-fé, but he is tormented by the slights and persecutions of daily obloquy. His political career is closed forever, since he has offended the only authority which is able to promote his success. Every sort of compensation, even that of celebrity, is refused to him. Before he published his opinions, he imagined that he held them in common with many others. But no sooner has he declared them openly than he is loudly censured by his overbearing opponents, whilst those who think without having the courage to speak, like him, abandon him in silence. He yields at length, oppressed by the daily efforts he has been making, and he subsides into silence, as if he was tormented by remorse for having spoken the truth. Fetters and headsmen were the coarse instruments which tyranny formerly employed, but the civilization of our age has refined the arts of despotism, which seemed, however, to have been sufficiently perfected before. The excesses of monarchical power had devised a variety of physical means of oppression. The democratic republics of the present day have rendered it as entirely an affair of the mind as that will which it is intended to coerce. Under the absolute sway of an individual despot, the body was attacked in order to subdue the soul, and the soul escaped the blows which were directed against it and rose superior to the attempt. But such is not the course adopted by tyranny in democratic republics. There, the body is left free, and the soul is enslaved. The sovereign can no longer say, "You shall think as I do on pain of death," but he says, "You are free to think differently from me and to retain your life, your property, and all that you possess. But if such be your determination, you are henceforth an alien among your people. You may retain your civil rights, but they will be useless to you, for you will never be chosen by your fellow citizens if you solicit their suffrages, and they will affect to scorn you if you solicit their esteem. You will remain among them, but you will be deprived of the rights of mankind. Your fellow creatures will shun you like an impure being, and those who are most persuaded of your innocence will abandon you too, lest they should be shunned in their turn. Go in peace. I have given you your life, but it is an existence incomparably worse than death." Monarchical institutions have thrown an odium upon despotism. Let us beware lest democratic republics should restore oppression and should render it less odious and less degrading in the eyes of the many, by making it still more onerous to the few. Works have been published in the proudest nations of the old world expressly intended to censure the vices and deride the follies of the times. La Bruyère inhabited the palace of Louis XIV when he composed his chapter upon the great, and Molière criticized the courtiers in the very pieces which were acted before the court. But the ruling power in the United States is not to be made game of. The smallest reproach irritates its sensibility, and the slightest joke which has any foundation in truth renders it indignant. From the style of its language to the more solid virtues of its character, everything must be made the subject of encomium. No writer, whatever be his eminence, can escape from this tribute of adulation to his fellow citizens. The majority lives in the perpetual practice of self-applause, and there are certain truths which the Americans can only learn from strangers or from experience. If great writers have not at present existed in America, the reason is very simply given in these facts. There can be no literary genius without freedom of opinion, and freedom of opinion does not exist in America. The Inquisition has never been able to prevent a vast number of anti-religious books from circulating in Spain. The empire of the majority succeeds much better in the United States, since it actually removes the wish of publishing them. Unbelievers are to be met with in America, but to say the truth, there is no public organ of infidelity. Attempts have been made by some governments to protect the morality of nations by prohibiting licentious books. In the United States, no one is punished for this sort of works, but no one is induced to write them, not because all the citizens are immaculate in their manners, but because the majority of the community is decent and orderly. In these cases, the advantages derived from the exercise of this power are unquestionable, and I am simply discussing the nature of the power itself. This irresistible authority is a constant fact, and its judicious exercise is an accidental occurrence. Effects of the tyranny of the majority upon the national character of the Americans. The tendencies which I have just alluded to are as yet very slightly perceptible in political society, but they already begin to exercise an unfavorable influence upon the national character of the Americans. I am inclined to attribute the singular paucity of distinguished political characters to the ever-increasing activity of the despotism of the majority in the United States. When the American Revolution broke out, they arose in great numbers, for public opinion then served not to tyrannize over, but to direct the exertions of individuals. Those celebrated men took a full part in the general agitation of mind common at that period, and they attained a high degree of personal fame, which was reflected back upon the nation, but which was by no means borrowed from it. In absolute governments, the great nobles who are nearest the throne flatter the passions of the sovereign, and voluntarily truckle to its caprices. But the mass of the nation does not degrade itself by servitude. It often submits from weakness, from habit, or from ignorance, and sometimes from loyalty. Some nations have been known to sacrifice their own desires to those of the sovereign with pleasure and with pride, thus exhibiting a sort of independence in the very act of submission. These peoples are miserable, but they are not degraded. There is a great difference between doing what one does not approve and feigning to approve what one does. The one is the necessary case of a weak person, the other befits the temper of a lackey. In free countries, where everyone is more or less called upon to give his opinion in the affairs of state, in democratic republics where public life is incessantly commingled with domestic affairs, where the sovereign authority is accessible on every side, and where its attention can almost always be attracted by vociferation, more persons are to be met with who speculate upon its foibles and live at the cost of its passions than in absolute monarchies. Not because men are naturally worse in these states than elsewhere, but the temptation is stronger and of easier access at the same time. The result is a far more extensive debasement of the characters of citizens. Democratic republics extend the practice of currying favor with the many, and they introduce it into a greater number of classes at once. This is one of the most serious reproaches that can be addressed to them. In democratic states, organized on the principles of the American republics, this is more especially the case where the authority of the majority is so absolute and so irresistible that a man must give up his rights as a citizen and almost abjure his equality as a human being if he intends to stray from the track which it lays down. In that immense crowd which throngs the avenues to power in the United States, I found very few men who displayed any of that manly candor and that masculine independence of opinion which frequently distinguished the Americans in former times, and which constitutes the leading feature in distinguished characters wheresoever they may be found. It seems at first sight as if all the minds of the Americans were formed upon one model, so accurately do they correspond in their manner of judging. A stranger does indeed sometimes meet with Americans who dissent from these rigorous formularies, with men who deplore the defects of the laws, the mutability and the ignorance of democracy, who even go so far as to observe the evil tendencies which impair the national character, and to point out such remedies as it might be possible to apply. But no one is there to hear these things besides yourself, and you, to whom these secret reflections are confided, are a stranger and a bird of passage. They are very ready to communicate truths which are useless to you, but they continue to hold a different language in public. If ever these lines are read in America, I am well assured of two things. In the first place, that all who peruse them will raise their voices to condemn me, and in the second place, that very many of them will acquit me at the bottom of their conscience. I have heard of patriotism in the United States, and it is a virtue which may be found among the people, but never among the leaders of the people. This may be explained by analogy. Despotism debases the oppressed much more than the oppressor. In absolute monarchies, the king has often great virtues, but the courtiers are invariably servile. It is true that the American courtiers do not say, "Sire" or "Your Majesty," a distinction without a difference. They are forever talking of the natural intelligence of the populace they serve. They do not debate the question as to which of the virtues of their master is preeminently worthy of admiration, for they assure him that he possesses all the virtues under heaven without having acquired them, or without caring to acquire them. They do not give him their daughters and their wives to be raised at his pleasure to the rank of his concubines, but by sacrificing their opinions, they prostitute themselves. Moralists and philosophers in America are not obliged to conceal their opinions under the veil of allegory. But before they venture upon a harsh truth, they say, "We are aware that the people which we are addressing is too superior to all the weaknesses of human nature to lose the command of its temper for an instant. And we should not hold this language if we were not speaking to men whom their virtues and their intelligence render more worthy of freedom than all the rest of the world. It would have been impossible for the sycophants of Louis XIV to flatter more dexterously. For my part, I am persuaded that in all governments, whatever their nature may be, servility will cower to force, and adulation will cling to power. The only means of preventing men from degrading themselves is to invest no one with that unlimited authority, which is the surest method of debasing them." The greatest dangers of the American republics proceed from the unlimited power of the majority. Governments usually fall a sacrifice to impotence or to tyranny. In the former case, their power escapes from them. It is wrested from their grasp in the latter. Many observers who have witnessed the anarchy of democratic states have imagined that the government of those states was naturally weak and impotent. The truth is that when once hostilities are begun between parties, the government loses its control over society. But I do not think that a democratic power is naturally without force or without resources. Say rather that it is almost always the abuse of its force and the misemployment of its resources that a democratic government fails. Anarchy is almost always produced by its tyranny or its mistakes, but not by its want of strength. It is important not to confound stability with force or the greatness of a thing with its duration. In democratic republics, the power which directs society is not stable, for it often changes hands and assumes a new direction. Author's note: this power may be centered in an assembly, in which case it will be strong without being stable, or it may be centered in an individual, in which case it will be less strong but more stable. But whichever way it turns, its force is almost irresistible. The governments of the American republics appear to me to be as much centralized as those of the absolute monarchies of Europe, and more energetic than they are. I do not therefore imagine that they will perish from weakness. Author's note: I presume that it is scarcely necessary to remind the listener here, as well as throughout the remainder of this chapter, that I am speaking not of the federal government, but of the several governments of each state, which the majority controls at its pleasure. If ever the free institutions of America are destroyed, that event may be attributed to the unlimited authority of the majority, which may at some future time urge the minorities to desperation and oblige them to have recourse to physical force. Anarchy will then be the result, but it will have been brought about by despotism. Mr. Hamilton expresses the same opinion in The Federalist, number 51. It is of great importance in a republic not only to guard the society against the oppression of its rulers, but to guard one part of the society against the injustice of the other part. Justice is the end of government. It is the end of civil society. It ever has been and ever will be pursued until it be obtained or until liberty be lost in the pursuit. In a society under the forms of which the stronger faction can readily unite and oppress the weaker, anarchy may as truly be said to reign as in a state of nature, where the weaker individual is not secured against the violence of the stronger. And, as in the latter state, even the stronger individuals are prompted by the uncertainty of their condition to submit to a government which may protect the weak as well as themselves, so in the former state will the more powerful factions be gradually induced by a like motive to wish for a government which will protect all parties, the weaker as well as the more powerful. It can be little doubted that, if the state of Rhode Island was separated from the Confederacy and left to itself, the insecurity of right under the popular form of government within such narrow limits would be displayed by such reiterated oppressions of the factious majorities that some power altogether independent of the people would soon be called for by the voice of the very factions whose misrule had proved the necessity of it. Jefferson has also thus expressed himself in a letter to Madison. The executive power in our government is not the only, perhaps not even the principal, object of my solicitude. The tyranny of the legislature is really the danger most to be feared, and will continue to be so for many years to come. The tyranny of the executive power will come in its turn, but at a more distant period. I am glad to cite the opinion of Jefferson upon this subject rather than that of another, because I consider him to be the most powerful advocate democracy has ever sent forth. Chapter 16. Causes Mitigating Tyranny in the United States. I have already pointed out the distinction which is to be made between a centralized government and a centralized administration. The former exists in America, but the latter is nearly unknown there. If the directing power of the American communities had both these instruments of government at its disposal, and united the habit of executing its own commands to the right of commanding, if, after having established the general principles of government, it descended to the details of public business, and if, having regulated the great interests of the country, it could penetrate into the privacy of individual interests, freedom would soon be banished from the New World. But in the United States, the majority, which so frequently displays the tastes and the propensities of a despot, is still destitute of the more perfect instruments of tyranny. In the American republics, the activity of the central government has never as yet been extended beyond a limited number of objects sufficiently prominent to call forth its attention. The secondary affairs of society have never been regulated by its authority, and nothing has hitherto betrayed its desire of interfering in them. The majority has become more and more absolute, but it has not increased the prerogatives of the central government. Those great prerogatives have been confined to a certain sphere, and although the despotism of the majority may be galling upon one point, it cannot be said to extend to all. However the predominant party in the nation may be carried away by its passions, however ardent it may be in the pursuit of its projects, it cannot oblige all the citizens to comply with its desires in the same manner.